Welcome back, my friends, to the show that never ends. This is another episode of the Coaster 101 podcast. I'm Andrew Stillwell, and if you're wondering a little bit why I, you know, changed up the show intro this week, we are doing something very unique for our show. We're kind of doing a history deep dive a little bit. We're talking Hard Rock Park this week, and that song Carnival 9 by Emerson, Lake and Palmer was on the Hard Rock Park website, and that's how they kind of first started advertising their park. But I wanted to bring on somebody who had firsthand experience at Hard Rock Park, and I would like to introduce Josh Liebman. Josh is a podcaster in his own right, host of the Guest Experience Show, which is a property of Roller Software, and also co-host of the Attraction Pros podcast. Both amazing podcasts. But Josh, how's it going? Thanks for joining us.
Andrew, I'm doing awesome. Thanks so much for having me. I feel like we've been talking about doing this for so long, and I'm just so glad to be here with you right now. So I'm excited for this.
It is exciting. And, you know, I figured there's no better time. This show is going to drop 2 days after Christmas. And so I figured a late Christmas gift to the audience of the Coaster 101 podcast is going to be a deep, shallow dive on Hard Rock Park. But, you know, for those who may have been living under a rock, aren't the most hardcore theme park enthusiasts, Hard Rock Park was a park that opened in 2008 in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Sitting on 55 acres, it was tucked in between a mega church and a medieval times and an old outlet mall. There was 5 roller coasters, a number of flat rides. They had some shows, concerts, and their icon and their mascot, they were the Bear Metal family, and they also had Winston the Punk Rock Bulldog. I'm sure we're going to talk a little bit about that as well. But Josh, I'm bringing you on the podcast because you hold the distinction as the only person I know who worked at Hard Rock Park, and you're an operations supervisor. So let's get right into it. What did that job entail?
Yeah, absolutely. So it was definitely one of the most unique moments in my career. And, you know, now I've been in the industry for close to 17 years. And, you know, prior to Hard Rock, I had worked for Disney. I had worked for Cedar Point. And then, you know, afterwards, I went on to work for Universal, and I opened Legoland at another park as well. And so that was definitely quite an interesting kind of crossroads, I would say, as my career in the industry. And like you mentioned, I was an operations supervisor, which as you translate that to several other parks, it could usually mean team leader, or it could mean ride supervisor, or somewhere in between. And so basically it was in the operations department, which was mostly rides and attractions. And as well as, like you mentioned, there were, you know, a few shows throughout the park as well. And pretty much, I mean, day to day operational duties. So making sure that that the attractions are opening up with the park and closing when the park closes, and everything in between from the standpoint of operational efficiency, safety, guest satisfaction. So pretty typical from what you would see in for most parks, but with the unique spin of it being Hard Rock, part of my duties also included the Hard Rock Live theater as well. So I actually oversaw the operation of many of the park's concerts, which brought in some pretty big names like the Eagles, like Moody Blues, Charlie Daniels, Kid Rock, Bowling for Soup, Sister Hazel, just to name a few. And there were several others. The majority of the summer, though, I was focused pretty much exclusively at Maximum RPM, which, as you know, was the an awesome premier coaster with a very unique Ferris wheel lift hill. So not the traditional chain lift, and not a limb or LSM launch either, but to get to the top of the ride, your ride vehicle boarded a Ferris wheel, which then, yes, took you to the top and then spat you out onto the coaster track.
Yes. I remember it fondly. I recall it being very temperamental for both seasons that it operated, both as Maximum RPM and Roundabout, but we'll get into that in a little bit. I want to talk a little bit kind of like, what was it like working at Hard Rock Park? Obviously, I remember that they kind of let the employees or team members or whatever their preferred nomenclature was kind of be themselves. They had the, you know, the punk rock haircuts and the tattoos and the piercings and all that. And everybody had these amazing tan and orange button-up shirts with like this tribal design on it. But what was it like just working at Hard Rock Park compared to Disney or Universal or Legoland or those other parks you had worked at previously?
Yeah, so I'll touch on the point that you just made right there, and I'll say that where we are at right now, thanks to a number of DEI initiatives at several parks throughout the, you know, throughout the world, really, employees or cast members or team members or, you know, whatever, like you said, the nomenclature is, are able to express themselves much more now than they were traditionally in terms of piercings and hairstyles and tattoos, because back in 2008, pretty much industry-wide, those were very much, you know, unacceptable from, you know, from the standpoint of the visual appearance. And there's the look, like the Disney look, which many parks modeled after. But at Hard Rock, you're encouraged to be yourself and express yourself in any way possible. Now, I personally, I'm on the little bit more of the modest end. So I think I grew a beard for the first time in my life because I had been working in theme parks for the last few years. So I had never done that before. It didn't look that great. It was really scraggly. It wasn't really kept. And I actually found that I felt I looked better with it shaved. But you know, it was so cool to be able to have so many coworkers and colleagues who didn't feel that they needed to cover up their tattoos or needed to kind of conceal their piercings or, you know, put all that away. Or, you know, if you wanted to dye your hair green, you could do that. And that was really unique. And that was, I would say, very, very inventive for the theme park industry at that time. And the reason for it was because it was Hard Rock, and Hard Rock very much encompasses that be yourself type of brand. You mentioned the what was it, tan and red, tan and orange or so. Yeah. So employees at Hard Rock were called crew members, as if you were kind of the roadies making the show, kind of, you know, putting together. Oftentimes we were referred to as rockers. But what was cool about that shirt actually is it was like a short sleeve button down, but you were encouraged to keep it open. And then underneath that, kind of along the lines of, you know, being able to express yourself, you could wear whether it was a Hard Rock Park branded shirt or a band shirt, you could represent that. So, you know, I'd go in, you know, I'd have my Beatles shirt, and, you know, someone else on my crew would have a Ramones shirt. And so there was a lot of leeway to be able to, I guess I'll go back to saying, like, express yourself, which turns into a positive guest experience, really. What was it like working there? I reflect back on it as just being one of the greatest summers of my life. And that's, you know, my personal, you know, reflection of that experience. You know, there were several hundred, there were a few thousand people who had worked there in various capacities that summer. And I know everyone has their own way of looking back on it, but I look back on it as just being an amazing point of growth and learning. For me at that point, it was my first time in a leadership role. Since I had, you know, started working in the industry a few years prior. And it was also the first time that I was part of a team that was opening a new park. And that is either a once in a lifetime experience or only a few times in a lifetime experience. I'm thankful to have been able to go on. I opened Legoland Florida. I opened Zoomer's Amusement Park in Fort Myers. But, you know, Hard Rock is always the first. So kind of my time there and my contributions that summer in that role of operations supervisor, I look back on that as being a pivotal point in my career and my development.
Yeah, I was like, I'm thinking now, you said you've been in the industry now 17 years, I'm doing the math. What was it that, did you just know this park was opening in Myrtle Beach and you're like, hey, I really need to be a part of this? Or what was it about Hard Rock that kind of was so kind of intriguing for you to, you know, leave the Florida parks to try something new in Myrtle Beach?
Yeah. So it definitely started with that. When the park was announced, it was like, all right, I got to go there. I got to do that. And then just through relentless networking, I ended up with a job interview. This all tied in with the IAAPA Expo in 2007, where I was an IAAPA ambassador. I was a show ambassador. So for those who are not familiar, it's the group of interns for the show that really work so hard behind the scenes to keep it going. And there was a lot of camaraderie within the ambassadors. And one of them, his name was Doug Akers. He had also gone to the same school that I had at UCF, Rosen College. He had just started there as an operations manager. So throughout the week, we got to talking, and he introduced me to the VP of operations. It's John Riggleman. And a couple weeks after IAAPA, I found myself on a road trip from Orlando to Myrtle Beach, where I don't think I dressed for it. I didn't realize how cold it was going to be, just like 8 hours north of Orlando. I was so used to, you know, the Florida winters, the Florida December, and spent a few days there. Yeah, a few days there, and interviewed for the job and was hired for operations unit supervisor, I think was the official title. So I know that it was really competitive too. So I was really grateful to have been able to have been given that opportunity. I knew a few other people who had applied and were considered, and I knew a few other people who were applied and accepted, and you know, that made the summer even more exciting because I was able to be there with some friends too. And it really started out with that interest, that desire, and then, you know, finding the path to get there, and then a little bit of luck of being offered the job. So yeah,
I love it. And then, you know, at your time as operations unit supervisor, the official title, we're going to call it, do you have anything that's like, that really just sticks out to you as like a really fond or interesting memory? I mean, did a car get stuck in the Ferris wheel lift that you had to like push, go up there with a stick and push somebody over, or anything like that? Any fun, fond memories before we kind of dive into the attractions of the park?
Yeah. So I think that happened maybe once or twice. Like you mentioned, that maximum RPM was a little temperamental, which is kind of the excitement of working on a new type of attraction. That whole summer is just full of, you know, amazing memories and experiences that were so unique. One of the ones that sticks out is really surrounding the grand opening. So it was a 2-day event. It was June 2nd and 3rd, 2008. Remember, it stormed that day too, which like that just, you know, adds like to the excitement and, you know, of just everything. But the grand opening included back-to-back concerts, one concert on the third with the Eagles, followed by Moody Blues. So at this point, Maximum RPM actually didn't open with the grand opening. It opened about 2 weeks later or so. Mm-hmm. So I was stationed at Hard Rock Live. So I was overseeing the operation of the grand opening concerts. So here I am, like 20, almost 21 years old, like running an Eagles concert. It's like that's something that, you know, was, you know, that in and of itself, you know, was really unique, and being able to see that happen within a theme park that was opening for the day. Now, if you think about it, like if you go to Universal and you see a concert there, like the band will come out and do the sound check during the day. If you're in front of the amphitheater at like 3 o'clock in the afternoon, like you'll see Casey and the Sunshine Band or like, you know, whoever it is that's, you know, that's out there. The Eagles were so particular. They're like, wait, we're playing in a theme park during standard operation. Like, we can't have anybody just walking by and casually seeing the Eagles doing their sound check. So it, you know, started with like, and the park is a circle. I mean, think of it mm-hmm. kind of modeled after Islands of Adventure. So so to do that, to cut off part of the circle and make people, you know, walk all the way around, there were just the operational logistics of it and kind of running back and forth, and even you know, park security, you know, I don't know if they were joking around with me or if they were, you know, if that was the word that they heard, but I was walking through just to get from one end to the other. And they said, you look at the stage, you turn to stone. And I'm like, okay, like I got one hand up this way. Like, don't, you know, don't look in the peripheral of your vision there. That's, you know, that's the Eagles doing their sound check. And what I remember was actually the concert then just, you know, went off flawlessly. And, you know, from an operations standpoint, and obviously like just being there and getting to see it, of course, was really cool for me personally. So I then probably leave work around midnight or so, maybe even a little bit later, kind of after the concert ends, we get the whole place, you know, emptied out, cleaned up, all that. I get in, and I mentioned John earlier, VP of operations. I get into work the next day. I think I'm supposed to start at 8 o'clock to get ready for then the Moody Blues concert, which was going to be, you know, later that evening. John comes up to me at like 7:45 or so, and he's like, Josh, I need your help. And I'm like, what is it? And he goes, the Moody Blues showed up early. And I'm like, yeah. And he goes, and the Eagles trashed their trailer last night. And I'm like, oh God. I was like, I mean, what do you expect? Right. It's mm-hmm. literally a rock band who came here. And because it was back-to-back concerts, you know, they were sharing the trailer. So it was like, this is just where we take the band. They're like, the Moody Blues are here and they're pissed. And I'm like, all right, let's go get it cleaned up. And just the experience of walking into this trailer and just, seeing how big of a mess it was, I was like, oh, this was the Eagles here that just trashed this trailer. And just the, I don't know, just the process of then coordinating and working with the park services and the custodial team just to get, where it's like, we need to clean up, you know, the mess that this rock band just left. So the next rock band can come in and do the exact same thing. And we'll do this again tomorrow with a little less urgency because, you know, they're, you know, we don't have another band coming tomorrow. So that was definitely a memory that, you know, sticks out to me because I was doing that while also trying to coordinate all the other operational logistics of getting my team together to make sure that that venue is good to go. And that we've got our like staging area where guests can wait and, you know, get all that just sorted out. So just from an operational logistics standpoint, it was so cool to be in that fast pace and intense of an environment. And then another one, you know, that comes to mind too, was like I mentioned, when Maximum RPM did open a couple weeks after, after the park did, when you open a new ride due to certain state regulations and, you know, due to just certain policies and procedures, needs to cycle empty a certain number of times. Every single ride vehicle needs to have a number of empty, full circuit, you know, complete dispatches before you can put a human being on the ride. I don't remember exactly what that was, but I knew that that maintenance had just finally turned the ride over to operations. We were so excited, you know, to be able to get it. And then we wanted to open the next day. So this was now, I got off work, I think at like 8 o'clock at night. Like I was probably the mid shift supervisor that day. And I remember I went home, showered, had a protein shake and drove right back to the park. Thankfully I lived, I think less than a mile away. So it was really easy to do that. And after the park closed, it was me and my buddy Jared, who was he was my supervisor. He was the area supervisor. He was also my roommate, which that in and of itself was kind of a comical, you know, component of the summer too. He walks up shortly after park closed, probably 10:30, 11 o'clock at night. He's holding a cooler with him, and I was like, "What? You just bring the beers so we can cycle this all night?" He opens it up. It's all like Red Bull and Rockstar and Monster. We're like, we got to get all these dispatches done. So the two of us just sat there, knocked back energy drinks all night. And it's not like we needed to, you know, announce clear or like check the lap bars or the things that you would see during normal operations. Like we literally just need to hit the button when the car comes back into the station. So we just keep doing that. And thankfully it's not like, you know, there aren't like tally marks on the wall or anything like that. Like I think it was counting it for us. And at some point, around 2:30, 3 o'clock in the morning or so, we get a fault light. And we, you know, in that normal circumstance during normal operations, you contact maintenance, they come, they check it out. It's probably like a tree branch or something, or like a leaf that fell on the track and covered a proxy, whatever it was. But we didn't have the ability to resolve that. And there was no maintenance there whatsoever. So we're like, well, like, what do we do? You know, we sat around for a bit. I think we made some phone calls and woke some people up. And I think it was a few hours before we were able to get that resolved. So that kind of set us back just a little bit. I think we came back and we just kept cycling again, you know, the next day as guests were peering on and saying, what's going on here? What's, you know, why isn't this ride open? That was, you know, questions we were taking for the first, you know, several weeks while the park, park was open to guests, but the ride wasn't open yet. And then I'll give one more actually that just came to mind here. So Maximum RPM, as you know, was in the British Invasion section of the park. You'll have to remind me what it was referred to the following year at Freestyle. The ride was Roundabout. But the other rides within British Invasion, there were a few other flat rides. There was the London Cab ride. There was the Magic Mushroom ride. And these were like just spin and puke rides, basically. Mm-hmm. And so one evening, you know, I was at the London Cab ride and was just, you know, observing the, you know, the team member that was operating the ride. And John Binkowski, chief creative officer for the park, God, just like one of my heroes, like such an imagination this guy has from both just kind of envisioning, you know, what the park could look like. And then from the business side of it, of being able to help, you know, get it done and, you know, bringing in, you know, the other executives that really got it off the ground. But he was constantly walking the park, not from a critical standpoint, but he would bring his family there just so they could experience it. And, you know, he'd go up and talk to employees, you know, from time to time. And so he was really about kind of getting into the vibe and getting into the character that you are. So he comes in, he brings his family on London Cab Ride, and they get on it. And or maybe he was actually just standing by. They were about to get on it. And then, you know, the girl kind of gives the safety spiel, and he walks up to the girl and he says, "Where is your British accent? You know, we're in the British section of the park." And, you know, she was kind of shy. She was like, "Well, I don't know if I could do a British accent." And she like just kind of keeps kind of giving her spiel. You could tell, I mean, she was doing her job perfectly, mm-hmm. flawlessly. She just, you know, she was doing it with her South Carolina accent, right? Not, you know, not her British accent. So she was like, "Josh, do you want to take over?" So I jump into the controls. It was when the family got on, and I can't even tell you what I said. But throughout the whole course of the ride, I just start speaking in a British accent of just probably saying like, "You guys look like you're having fun," or "Oh, there you go," or "Oh, hope you don't get sick," or whatever it was. Definitely not going to recreate it here on the podcast here. Just imagine me speaking in a British accent and just being ridiculous. And John just gets off and he goes, "There you go." And he like just gives me a big high five. And, you know, that was something that I was able to take with me and say, all right, someone who's overseeing kind of this area and the staff members who are running it, what can we do to make sure that we're getting this vibe going? So the guests who are coming here, you know, they just walked out of Rock and Roll Heaven. They got off Led Zeppelin. They crossed the bridge. Now they're in British Invasion. They saw kind of the arrow direct them to the other side of the street. So it was kind of funny the way that it was put together, you know, like that of making it look like you then needed to go on the left side of the road. I was like, let's give them the great rides that they're here for, but let's bring all of our personality and our vibe into what we do too. So I would say those are three probably long-winded memories that I can give you from the park from a whole summer just full of amazing memories.
That's awesome. Yeah, I was after you were talking about that Eagles thing, I was going to say, well, forgive the pun, but they put you you were living life in the fast lane very quickly, it seems like. Let's talk these attractions at Hard Rock Park. And according to Wikipedia, there's more than 50 attractions when you include all the rides, shows, and probably areas to see, things like that. But we'll start with the five roller coasters. Obviously, there was Led Zeppelin the Ride, which was a B&M steel roller coaster, not quite a hyper coaster. It's only 150 feet tall. There was Maximum RPM, which we talked about a good amount. There was also Eagle's Life in the Fast Lane, which was a Vekoma mine train that played Life in the Fast Lane. There was Shake, Rattle, and Roller Coaster, also from Vekoma, Junior Roller Coaster, and Slippery When Wet, which was kind of this premier ride suspended coaster, similar to Roller Soaker at Hershey Park or Flying Super Saturator, Carowinds. I don't think it had the interactive water element. I fondly remember my first couple of rides on Led Zeppelin the Ride, and I had no idea that Whole Lot of Love was a song. I mean, I was, 2008, I would have been 17, 18 years old at this point. And so I didn't really know my Led Zeppelin, but, you know, the ride was famous because Led Zeppelin wanted them to play that whole song over the course of the ride. And it's like a 6 or 7 minute song, I feel like. I feel like it's a highly underrated B&M roller coaster that not a lot of people got to experience. Josh, what do you agree as far as, you know, underrated steel, you know, big name B&M coasters? I feel like that might be the most underrated coaster they've ever built.
It absolutely was definitely, it was underrated, but it was so well received by the park and the fans. Because if you think about it, if you're looking at kind of the local area of Myrtle Beach, and yeah, we were, you know, serving the tourist market, but just think of people who live there. It's maybe about 4 or so hours to Charlotte to get to Carowinds. And I think it's about 6 hours to get to Atlanta, to Six Flags over Georgia, and like 8 to 9 hours to get to Orlando. So Led Zeppelin, even being, you know, 150, 160 feet or so, was the biggest spectacle they'd ever seen, right? I mean, it was just absolutely mammoth. I mean, you could see it for so far away in Myrtle Beach, and it just obviously had, you know, amazing curb appeal from that. And then you tie in the fact that it is timed perfectly to Whole Lot of Love. just completely brings it to an entirely new level. So you mentioned, yeah, they play the entire song. It's a long song. That song is longer than most roller coasters. And in this instance, they were unable to get Led Zeppelin to say re-record it or allow them to use only a portion of the song. So this is what I recall. If you look at Moody Blues, you know, Nights in White Satin, Moody Blues re-recorded Nights in White Satin for the park. The Eagles re-recorded Life in the Fast Lane for the park. They were unable to get Led Zeppelin. In fact, this was only the second time a Led Zeppelin song was used for commercial purposes. And the first was in a Cadillac commercial with the song Rock and Roll from, I think that commercial was probably playing around the time that the park was open, because I remember that being really familiar. So because of that, they built a pre-show for the ride that then, you know, if you think of a standard, you know, B&M roller coaster in any traditional amusement park, you wait in line, you get into the station, you get on the ride. And from an operational standpoint, there was no reason to change that, you know, as well with Led Zeppelin. But because the entire song needed to play, what they were able to do was cut it up into three pieces. So you go into a pre-show where you see this footage from Led Zeppelin and you learn a little bit about them and you get really pumped. And then the song begins. And then if you are familiar with the song, those who are familiar know that there's a little bit of a musical break in between. That just plays on a loop in the station. And then the ride itself was designed specifically for the elements of the song. So you hear Robert Plant shouting love with like 46 O's, you know, as you're going down the drop. And then every time he goes, is, you know, you felt that with the Cobra Roll, with the loop, with, you know, the corkscrew, every element of the ride. And then it ends as you're pulling into the station. So I don't know about you, Andrew, but whenever I hear Whole Lot of Love, I only think about Led Zeppelin, the ride. I'm guessing you're the same, right?
100%. And it's that every time I hear, again, Carnival 9 that I kind of let off the show with, same thing. I think of that flash video on the Hard Rock Park website that was like, hey, this park is coming. Rock and Roll's first theme park is coming, you know, and get ready for it. It's just every time, if it's on XM radio or whatever, I will pull out my phone, not while driving, allegedly. I will take a picture of the screen and I will probably tweet something from Coaster 101 and just be like, ah, just reminiscing about Hard Rock Park. You did mention Nights in White Satin, the trip, which we have to go into a deep dive on Nights in White Satin, because that is the world's greatest dark ride. I rode it one time. I was far too young to really understand the secondary meanings of the attraction. But I think Sally crushed that. I think the park crushed that. That, to me, I feel like is a signature attraction, probably the signature attraction of Hard Rock Park.
It was just so epic. The ride only goes a few miles an hour, so it's not thrilling. It's not intense. And then just the imagery around it, and kind of the double meaning of everything in it, was pulled off so well that if you stood at the exit and watched guests getting off that ride, the parents with kids are getting off and you see the kids being like, oh, that was fun, that was really cool. And the parents are getting off, they'll be like, whoa, that brings me back, right? People are getting flashbacks, you know, from riding the ride. It was psychedelic. It was nothing short of a simulated acid trip. So I don't know what that's like in real life, but I've been on Nights in White Satin, so I've been told that it's close.
Yes, it was. I remember the one thing that vividly sticks out of my mind. The person who got off me there or got off the ride before me, they got off the ride and it could be something with the exit path or something. It was like motion sickness. And they had a protein spill, I believe is the industry term, in the exit queue. And I was like, oh, all right, cool. So it's just like, it was fantastic. There's got to be POVs. I know Sally probably has one on their website. So if you have never seen this attraction or you're hearing about it for the first time, one, get out from under the rock you've been living under for the past 13 years. But two, go to YouTube, find a POV of this, and just watch it. And it will not do the ride justice. But again, there's a reason that 13 years later, Afford operated for all of 4 months, that people are still talking about this Moody Blues Dark Ride. I'm trying to think of any other attractions. I know, Josh, you mentioned the London Cab Ride. That was a Huss Rodeo. There was, let's see, the Pinball Wizard Arcade, the Punk Pit. There was, you know, a couple of rides, a couple of shows. I do remember the show that was like Malibu Beach Party that played Bowling for Soup, High School Never Ends. That was a fun one. So I just, this park, it packed, it was a small park. I mean, only 55 acres, and it packed a lot into a pretty small footprint. It was, you know, not as well received. It opened in a really weird time economically for the country in 2008, right before the Great Recession. And, you know, Josh, when you were working there, was the writing on the wall kind of towards the end of the season that something was amiss? Like, what was it like working there kind of as it was headed towards that closure?
Yeah, well, the whole summer was really interesting, especially because, you know, my background just prior to that, I was working in Magic Kingdom, right? And it was like just before the recession, or maybe at the cusp of it, I would say. And, you know, prior to that, spent a couple summers at Cedar Point. So I was very used to seeing, you know, a theme park that had 30, 40, 50,000 people, you know, on a standard day during the summer. And then at Hard Rock, just being, you know, kind of seeing a fraction of that as being kind of the standard, you know, attendance throughout, you know, throughout the summer. Was the writing on the wall? Maybe. I don't know if I could say that definitively, but you did make a really good point as far as the time that it opened. It opened in the summer of 2008. And sometimes people say, well, why, you know, why did they open the park in 2008? Well, when you start planning a park 7 years before, you know, in the early 2000, 2001 or so, you're not just going to push it off just because it's, you know, it's not as great of an economic time, because obviously if it sits there not making money, then, you know, then that's not going to do it any good either. So the timing of it was unfortunate, was unlucky. I don't know if you remember gas prices that summer. I remember filling up. At one point I took a road trip, went to Carowinds, went to, you know, Busch Gardens in Williamsburg. And I just remember being in North Carolina somewhere, filling up my tank for like $4.35 a gallon, just thinking like, this is the worst time in the history of gasoline to be on a road trip right now. Like, so the, you know, the economic component of it was, you know, was tough. And then, introducing a new theme park concept to an audience that wasn't used to it was also, you know, very tough as well. So I, being kind of in operations, seeing kind of what guests were coming in with, what their expectation was, and then making sure we could meet and exceed that was a challenge, because there wasn't a foundation for an expectation that was fully in place yet. You know, it was largely just out there and being delivered through a lot of marketing, a lot of advertising campaigns, but people are going to come in with their preset notion of what it should be and what they want it to be, particularly from probably what they were used to experiencing. If these were people, you know, we got a lot of people coming in from the Northeast. So I remember Pennsylvania, New Jersey, big audience there, which is also has no shortage of theme parks in that area. So coming in and yeah, it was a little bit different than what you'll see at Dorney Park or Great Adventure or Maury's Piers, right? Or Hershey, or Knoebels. And sometimes that might misalign with what people wanted to experience. And now, I mean, kind of flash forward to today, everything that I focus on within guest experience, a lot of it has to do with aligning it with what it is that guests expect, and talk about meeting their expectations and exceeding their expectations. And when it doesn't meet their expectation, that's considered a service failure. And that's completely up to the guest, right? So that doesn't matter if they're right or wrong. It is completely about how they reflect on their experience as it relates to what it was that they expected. You mentioned at the beginning of the podcast that it was, you could see the, you know, these mega churches from inside the park, which means that, you know, you bring in kind of an edgy rock and roll atmosphere that might not necessarily align with much of the demographic of, you know, of those who are around, who are expecting something that is fully rated G and family friendly, because that's what they're used to if they've gone to Orlando or if they've gone to the parks in Pennsylvania and New Jersey. So being able to kind of connect the experience with the expectation was always an interesting challenge for us in the operations team of serving guests and making sure that we're not just putting them on rides and hitting dispatch, but we're making sure that we are truly ensuring that whatever it is that they expected when they came to the park, that we can top that. Because it was a $50 ticket, which at the time is modest if you compare it to Orlando, but, you know, premium if you compare it to many regional parks. So people were coming in almost with kind of a little bit of Orlando type mentality, mm-hmm. when it was never intended to be an Orlando style experience, if that makes sense. And that doesn't mean that it's better or worse. It's not good. It's bad. It's, you know, it simply is a different type of product. Now, those who came in and they said, I'm a huge fan of rock and roll. I love everything else about Hard Rock. I love the cafe. I love the casinos. I love, you know, all of that. You know, there were people who came in and said, I would gladly pay $50 again, you know, to do the exact same thing and have the exact same experience over and over again. There were a lot of annual pass holders. There are faces that are now coming to mind more than 13 years later of people I would see every single day inside the park. So there absolutely were those raving fans. But kind of as, you know, as history has kind of led us to that, there wasn't enough to sustain the demand for the park, which is really sad, because the product, in my opinion, was just second to none. It was so unique, and you know, it's something that we haven't even really seen it since then. And I've always been hoping to kind of see it reborn in some capacity ever since that summer.
Yeah, I think the location. I think people go to Myrtle Beach. They go for the beach, they go for the mini golf, they go for those stores where everything's 99 cents and then real small print it says on one rack. Like that's your annual family vacation. I don't know necessarily, and Myrtle Beach, again, I got to plug Coaster 101 here. It does have a decent history of roller coasters in Myrtle Beach, going back to the Gay Dolphin Park and obviously the Pavilion, Family Kingdom, places like that. Go check that out, coaster101.com. Just search Myrtle Beach. It'll pop up. But I don't think people necessarily go to Myrtle Beach for theme parks on roller coasters and rides like that. And it was, you know, its location was, you know, you're 5 miles off the beach at this point. And I feel like in Myrtle Beach, once you get inland past like Broadway at the beach, where, again, the Pavilion kind of lives on with some rides. There's a Topgolf there. There's the Speed Park, the Wax Museum. Once you get further inland there, I think you're losing a lot of your kind of tourist market, who I think this was primarily marketed to. I think,
yeah.
Do you think if it had opened in a different location, do you think it would still be operating today, even given the economic situation that it opened in?
So I can tell you, when I got back to Central Florida, that was a question that came up a lot, you know, amongst, you know, my friends, and definitely something I thought a lot about too. And I can tell you, back then, I remember thinking, do you know where the Florida State Fairground is in Tampa? There's the amphitheater there, mm-hmm. and then it's literally right across from the Hard Rock Casino. It's right off of I-4. And I just remember thinking, if Hard Rock Park was right here, there's plenty of space for all of it. There's plenty of space for the park, for parking. And then there's this massive amphitheater that holds, I think, at least 10,000 people or so. I've been there many times for many, usually Jimmy Buffett concerts, but you know, a few others as well. And then, you know, I remember standing on the roof of the parking garage at the casino and looking out over it with a friend. This was probably in late 2008, early 2009 or so. And thinking, yeah, then you build a pedestrian, you know, bridge across I-4 and bring it over there. And now you've got this massive Hard Rock complex. So Tampa always came to mind as something of, you know, if it was built here, it would perhaps have a better chance. Of course, that's speculation. That's, you know, this is just, you know, me rattling off kind of where my brain goes. But if you think about that, it's because if someone were to say Orlando, well, given the nature of the product, it might be a little too edgy from, you know, for what Orlando might might crave and desire, but you know, you build it in Tampa and it's just a little bit outside. Now you tie it in with the, you know, the Busch Gardens market and, you know, bringing that all together. So that to me is kind of where I've thought. And then of course, Vegas too, you know, it would probably be a good spot too, but I'm sure there is a reason why there's no major theme park in, you know, in Vegas these days. And that's, you know, that's probably a whole nother conversation that you could dive into with probably, other people who are smarter than I am on that topic.
Well, we'd love to have you back. If you want to talk about why there's no theme park in Vegas, you're welcome anytime. we got to talk now with Hard Rock Park, obviously closing in August of 2008, there was the whole saga of the Hard Rock Park, and I believe Theme Park University, will link this in the show notes. They did a great deep dive, multi-article write-up interviewing the key leadership people, so be sure to check that out. The next year, 2009, Hard Rock Park was kind of reborn as Freestyle Music Park. Not really any licensing. All the Hard Rock Park attractions had to be kind of skinned and rethemed. And did you ever make it back down to Freestyle Music Park?
I wish I would have. I did not go back to Myrtle Beach after that summer. The last time I went back was actually about 3 years or so ago. And that was my first time back. So when I did go back, I toured the park. I took a self-guided tour, because I was able to get right into it. But no. So for that, I actually have a question for you, because yes, you said that you're the only person you know who visited both facilities, both Hard Rock Park and Freestyle Music Park, the next summer. So I'd actually love to know how they compared and which experience you preferred.
Which I preferred is tough. I got to go with Hard Rock Park. I will say, you know, the summer we went, summer 2009, Led Zeppelin and Ryan became the Time Machine, which they used the onboard audio to play kind of this montage mashup, not really even a mashup, of songs from the 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s, maybe the 50s too. I don't remember if it was four or five. Legend has it that they use that format because they wouldn't have to secure the rights. Like, they could play the, I think, fair use of like 10 or 12 seconds. But I do remember going to Freestyle Music Park and there was nobody there. And it was really nice to kind of marathon the Time Machine or Led Zeppelin. They still kept the blimp station. They still kept the blimp trains. The onboard audio was the same. It was just playing a different audio track. I remember they took the karaoke queue line, which is something I want to revisit real quick now that I'm jogging. they took that out of Maximum RPM, which became roundabout. The British Invasion area became Across the Pond. And I think the biggest thing for me that was just like the world's greatest letdown was Knights in White Satin, the Trip became Monstars of Rock. It was... We've got a video of it on our YouTube channel that I don't condone filming on rides. I will make that clear. I got in that ride and I said, I have to film this. It is this bad. Like, and with no offense to those who created it, it was just, you took, again, the world's greatest dark ride and you turned it into something. You turned it into basically a Boo Blasters without a gun. And it's just, it was a huge letdown, but it was just, it's just kind of, I don't want to say hilariously bad because that's not fair. And there are people who listen to this podcast in the industry who may have had a hand in that. And I don't want to offend anybody, but it was bad. It was just really bad. So I've got to go with my experience at Hard Rock Park. I mean, again, Led Zeppelin the ride with that kind of the pre-show. And I'm now remembering like getting the brain jogging of the British woman who's like, John Bonham. Drums, like talking about the history of Led Zeppelin and all that stuff. And it's, again, it was a interesting time to be a theme park fan. Like, I moved to North Carolina in 2000. I grew up in Florida, and so I was used to the Disneys and Universals and things like that. And this is right before Carowinds had kind of hit its stride. They opened Intimidator in 2010, and so I was still 2 hours from Carowinds in Central North Carolina, but I was 2.5 hours from Myrtle Beach. And so that was a family vacation for us. So I was always eager to ride roller coasters wherever we went, and bless my parents' hearts for allowing me to like add a theme park trip to our Myrtle Beach vacation 2 years in a row with that $50 ticket. It was, I have no idea why they agreed to it, but thank them. I thank them for doing that. But I think Freestyle kind of neutered a lot of that character you were talking about with Hard Rock Park. A lot of the in jokes were gone. You know, the codpiece fish and chips, that was a restaurant at Hard Rock Park. I don't think that was there. Alice's restaurant. So
good. Oh, best French fries.
Alice's restaurant after the Arlo Guthrie song, that wasn't there. You know, the roadie stunt show, which was a pretty good stunt show, if I recall, was, you know, turned into a CSI just traveling thing that appeared at regional parks in that time of year. So I think Hard Rock Park had a lot more character. It was, again, the bones were the same, but the exterior was, you know, you had that Hard Rock brand, you had the licensing, you had, again, the Bare Metal family and Winston the punk rock dog and all that stuff. I gotta go Hard Rock Park here. It was a fun experience. Again, as a 18, 19 year old kid, it was fun to take my family vacation and go ride a B&M roller coaster and a Vekoma roller coaster. But I could see kind of the writing on the wall in 2009. I was like, this may not be here if we come back next year. So, and lo and behold, it was. So, or wasn't, rather.
Yeah. I mean, there are so many people who I talk to who say that their biggest regret as a coaster enthusiast or, you know, as someone, you know, in the industry was not making it to Hard Rock in its first season and not making it to Freestyle in its, you know, in its first season, in its only season. And if I recall correctly, they had a better season than Hard Rock did from an attendance standpoint, from a number of operating days standpoint. Mm-hmm. And I think if my memory serves me right, they closed on their designated closing day with, you know, an invitation to come back when they reopened in 2010. So it seemed like there was a lot of optimism. So it's you know, it's a shame. I shouldn't say it's a shame. It's sad to just see, you know, kind of what happened to the park and to the property. But, you know, the legacy, man, you know, it gained more fame since it closed.
And that is 100%
true. More notoriety than sadly it did while it operated.
The eBay deep dives that I've gone on for Hard Rock Park memorabilia, it's embarrassing, my eBay, because then you have to go Hard Rock Park minus cafe minus pin minus pins, because everybody wants to sell you the Hard Rock Cafe pins, and it's just like,
yeah,
there's some good stuff. I think somebody's got the signage from the Pinball Wizard Arcade. I've seen that on eBay. So if I had $1 million, I'm not getting rich doing the theme park podcast, but I would that would look great in a game room or a man cave somewhere.
Well, I got to tell you, I mean, like, the retail that I bought that summer, like, obviously, you know, not knowing, you know, the park's future, the park's fate. I mean, it's in a box. It's stored. Like, the coffee mugs I have, those are not in active circulation. I will not let anything happen to those T-shirts, mugs, shot glasses, anything that I bought with the park's logo on it.
So do you have a favorite piece of memorabilia or merch that you bought that summer?
Favorite piece of memorabilia. So I'll give you memorabilia that's not merch.
Yes.
And there was this giant vinyl banner that stood in front of Maximum RPM before the ride opened. So like I mentioned, it opened after the park did. And I'm guessing when you visited, RPM was open. So it was after June 15th. I'll tell you, that was the day. So there was this huge banner. It was probably maybe like 9 feet wide by like 2.5 to 3 feet tall or so. And it was just the banner saying that the ride was closed. And if you recall the theming of the building, it was themed to the Pink Floyd album Animals. So it was a big factory. Mm-hmm. And so it was like this sort of manufacturer like message of being like, this plant has been ordered closed by, and then it says, Director of Plant Engineering Services, but it just said DOPES, D-O-P-E-S. You know, we apologize for the inconvenience. that banner after the park closed. So I mentioned my buddy Jared, who he was my supervisor at the park. We lived together that summer. We then lived together again when we graduated college for, you know, for a couple of years. He managed to acquire that banner. I think he still has it in his garage or somewhere. But when we moved into our apartment, right, when we graduated, we measured out our kitchen counter and the kind of the base of it. Mm-hmm. And it, by the luck of God, it was the exact dimensions of that banner. So for 2.5 years, we displayed that banner in our apartment. And then we had another roommate. His name was Brad. He was really into lighting. So we like strung up these like lights that then shined down on it. So we turned it on. It was like this perfect display of, and then we just brought in a whole bunch of other stuff. And we called our apartment the museum because it was all like artifacts and memorabilia from theme parks. But that is absolutely my favorite. My favorite piece of memorabilia from, you know, from the park. And then, you know, from a merch standpoint, the souvenir bottle, and actually, on Attraction Pros, we were just talking about, you know, the importance of souvenir cups and souvenir bottles in theme parks. The one from Hard Rock, it was clear plastic and it was in the shape of a guitar. Mm-hmm. And it had a strap on it that was like a guitar case or a guitar strap. So you could actually like wear it on you and, you know, whatever the cost of the bottle was, you got free refills all summer. So I've got that lying around somewhere too, also, you know, protected in a vault somewhere. But it was the shape of it, like it was just so unique. So I would say, yeah, there's a two-part answer, favorite piece of memorabilia and favorite piece of merch.
I love it. And then I did say, I've got to go back. This is kind of jogging back in the conversation. Maximum RPM was kind of unique. They did have a karaoke cue line.
Mm-hmm.
What can you tell us?
Better or worse?
Yeah, I was going to say, what can you tell us about the karaoke queue line?
The coolest thing ever done in terms of keeping guests engaged while waiting in line. And I know that that's kind of a big statement there because a lot of parks will have DJs in line or like games and, you know, or obviously like this was before virtual queues for the most part. So having that type of entertainment in the queue that was 100% interactive really kept people occupied. Now, as someone who stood on that ride platform for 10 to 12 hours a day, painful in some cases, painful because yeah. the individual and the queue was built for this. So there's the queue ramp that goes through mm-hmm. the building, and then there was like a separate staircase. So people would get out of line, they'd go sing, and then they'd go back to their place in line. And there was always a host there. There was an MC who was, you know, speaking in a British accent, like they were an entertainment crew member. And they would just do snippets of the songs just because, you know, if the line for the ride is, you know, 15 minutes and, you know, you get up there and you sing, you know, Freebird, you know, you're kind of, you know, wasting everyone's, you know, potential. So there was just like, it would just be like the first verse of, oh God, I remember Another One Bites the Dust. Jitterbug, you know, it was a lot of British, mostly like 80s pop. So it was in the British Invasion section of the park. The whole ride was themed to British, you know, British 80s pop. So there was just so much of that. And you know, there was Genesis and there was, you know, there was, I mean, there, yeah, I mean, like just the classic, like hits from the maybe 70s, 80s, and 90s, but I think like mm-hmm. the core of it was in the 80s. They would bring people up, they'd select a song, they'd sing the verse and embarrass themselves and then get back in line. And what was fun was like on slow days, like the grouper for the ride, so that the person who would, you know, ask how many is in your party and direct you to, you know, where you're going. If it was really slow, like they would just go up and sing, like, you know, it was, it just added a really fun level of entertainment and engagement, to keep people occupied while they're waiting in line.
I love it. And then the last question I've got for you, and then we're going to talk Attraction Pros and the Guest Experience Podcast a little bit. This could be a loaded question. What do you miss most about Hard Rock Park, either an attraction from your time there? What do you miss the most?
That is absolutely a loaded question. Well, you had me thinking about the fish and chips that were that I pretty much lived off of all summer. God, those are so good. I definitely miss the people that I worked with. you know, I was fortunate enough to maintain a relationship with, you know, with many people beyond that. The energy and in some cases the stress, the 90-hour work weeks. I know that's the weirdest thing to miss. And no, I don't necessarily miss the like exhaustion that came with it, but there is just something so unique of being in that type of environment where we're all here together. We all have some background, either in the industry or not in the industry, and we're here towards the same goal, and it's to get this park open and operating. And that feeling of grand opening was, you know, it was just amazing. And if I could add one more thing that we haven't talked about yet, would be the Bohemian Rhapsody fireworks show. So just like I mentioned, every time I hear Whole Lot of Love, I think of Led Zeppelin, The Ride. Every time I hear Bohemian Rhapsody, not only do I think of that fireworks show, I can literally smell the pyro. 13 and a half years later, like I can cue every single pyro launch, where it was and what it smelled like. That is also something I miss too.
See, I feel like for most people that's Wayne's World, but I was only there during the day. I never was around at night to see the fireworks show. Okay, I'm going to have to look this up. This is, man. Well, I tell you what, if you're listening to this podcast and you've enjoyed Josh, I know I have personally. Josh is also the host and co-host of two other podcasts. He is the co-host of the Attractions podcast with Matt Heller, and also hosts the Guest Experience Show. Josh, what can you tell us about your two other podcasts? And I appreciate you taking the time for our show when you talk into a microphone for a semi-living.
Yeah, no, I totally appreciate it. And yeah, thanks for bringing those up. So yeah, Attraction Pros, like you mentioned, I co-host that with Matt Heller. We've been doing that for over 4 years now. At the time of this recording, episode 224 just went live. So we have been releasing content every single Tuesday for 224 straight weeks. We interview top leaders in the industry. So leaders, executives, and influencers are our primary, I would say, guests that we have on the show. So we've had Jeffrey Siebert from Six Flags Fiesta Texas. We've had Bridget Bywater from Kings Dominion. We've had Jim Shea from Premier. We recently had Jake Kilcup from Rocky Mountain Construction. So we talked to people both on the operator and the supplier side of the business. We were talking about Sally Dark Rides earlier. We had John Wood a few months ago, so I got to talk to him about Knights in White Satin, which was really cool, really special for me. And yeah, if you are interested, I would say if you're interested in growing a career in the industry or learning about perhaps the business side of it, and particularly we look at a lot of it from a lens of leadership. That's I would say that's Matt's area of focus and specialty, and mine comes from the side of guest experience. So those two really blend and clash in all the best ways and come up frequently in conversations. And then there are several episodes where Matt and I will just banter for, you know, 45-50 minutes or so on a particular topic, and you know, we enjoy those types of conversations too. So yeah, if you want to know kind of, I would say, the sort of how the industry works and, you know, what many of the top leaders in the business are thinking and saying. We had the founder and director of Meow Wolf, you know, a few months ago, Vince Cadlebeck. That was just so cool to hear his creative process and, you know, be able to talk all about that. We had Pam Landworth, president of Give Kids the World, a little over a year ago. That was a special interview, a really important one. And I mean, so many others too, you know, too many to count in terms of just the amazing people we've had the chance to talk to. And then over on you mentioned the Guest Experience Show. Yeah. So that was launched earlier this year. Well, if it's still 2021, earlier this year, if not, then last year, last March of 2021. And like you mentioned, created by Roller Software. So they asked me to come on board as the guest experience evangelist, which I know it's audio only, but I have to give air quotes when I say that because it's definitely the most unique title that I've ever had. So like I mentioned, you know, I've been focusing from the guest experience side of the business for many years now and talking about just best ways to deliver a phenomenal experience in all aspects of the industry. So theme parks, family entertainment centers, zoos, museums, aquariums, Trampoline parks is an area that roller is really strong and prominent in, which is also kind of a line of the business that I never expected to get into. If you would have told me 5 years ago, and I wouldn't have even known that existed. And now I've met so many amazing people in that side of the business. So I talked to thought leaders in terms of guest experience. So I've had people who are, GMs of parks and FECs, or people who are director or VP of guest experience at their particular organization. A few days ago, I was chatting with the president of luxury suite directors who work specifically with like stadiums and arenas from premium seating. So we got to talk about the premium side of guest experience. And then the latest episode, depending on when you're listening to this, I was actually with the owner of a baseball team in Savannah. Andrew, have you heard of the Savannah Bananas?
I have seen their TikToks. They are the greatest thing I've ever seen.
Well, you need to listen to the interview I just did with Jesse Cole. It is one of, if not the most ridiculous conversation I've ever had with anybody, especially on a podcast. Just so cool to hear kind of his fans first mentality. Both of those podcasts are available on Apple Podcasts, they're on Spotify and Google Podcasts. And for Attraction Pros, you can find it at attractionpros.com. For the guest experience show, you can go to roller.software, and then you can find it from going there. You click learn and then the guest experience show, and then it's got its own kind of designated website with a billboard sized picture of my face on it that, you can, go look at, stare at that and click away from that or at least scroll down to all the interviews there. They're all hosted on the website.
Perfect. And if people want to follow you or Attraction Pros, where can they find you on social media?
Sure. So I love to engage on both Twitter and LinkedIn. LinkedIn, you could just search my name, Josh Liebman. On Twitter, it is at @Joshua_Liebman. And then Attraction Pros is all one word. Some people will confuse it with saying Attractions Pro or try to split it into two words. So if you can't find it, then just make sure Attraction Pros, like attractions industry professionals, all one word on Twitter, on LinkedIn, it's on Facebook, it's on Instagram. And like I mentioned, attractionpros.com.
I love it. Well, as a writer for the sometimes named coasters101.com, I completely get where people just give you an S when you don't necessarily need it. But Josh, I appreciate you taking the time coming on talking Hard Rock Park. Really love this. We're going to have you back at some point. I don't even care what we're going to talk about, but we'll have you back. But after you follow Attraction Pros and Josh on social media, make sure you're following Coaster 101 on all forms of social media. We are at Coaster 101 anywhere you can consume the platform. Also have a website, as I mentioned earlier, coaster101.com. There's some articles deep in the archives about Hard Rock Park, but there's some more articles about the history of roller coasters in Myrtle Beach. Be sure to check that out. Also, if you're listening, make sure you're liking, rating, reviewing, subscribing, telling your friends to listen, bugging people to come on the Coaster 101 podcast after a year and a half, because maybe you'll finally be able to make it work and we'll get a great conversation like we just had with Josh. Thanks, as always, to Justin Mabry of JM Music Design for our theme music, and we will talk to you in 2022. See ya.
Thanks, Andrew. Thanks for all that you do.